Der Design-Podcast der Burg.
Let's start. Hello, welcome to the already fifth episode of the Hurra Hurra Podcast. And today it's a bit special because, as you already hear, this is not as usual in German language, but in English language. And this has a very special reason because our guest for this episode is Imad Gabriel. And we basically met, but really didn't meet at the Hurra Hurra Festival last year because Imad came in with a proposal for his workshop, and through the open call that we have sent out, let's say two months in advance of the festival. And it was a pity because I couldn't really dive into your workshop or meet you because I was so busy and not fainting because of being so busy. And that's why I only can remember that you were wearing this, the most wonderful suit of the whole festival. And because this is quite oberflächlich, I don't know what the English word is, like
shallow.
Yeah, thanks. That is quite shallow. I want to ask you to introduce yourself, please.
Thanks for having me on this podcast, Christian. So I'm a Berlin-based designer. I originally come from Lebanon, and I was very happy to be at Hurra Hurra and to be wearing the mustard suit. It was, it was an interesting experience being in Halle. It was a very nice festival, actually. I have great memories of it, and I always give it as an example to a lot of people as like a student-organized festival that actually works. So, thank you.
I have your CV here, and I could read it, but I would be more happier if you could just tell a bit about the way you came from being not a student to become a student and then turning into a professional designer.
Mm-hmm. So in a nutshell, I did my bachelor in graphic design in Beirut, Lebanon, and then I worked in the field since a very young age. So since I was 18 or something, in parallel with my university. And then I started working for an agency based in Abu Dhabi, and the design team was in Beirut, and we built it together. So I kind of found myself in the creative director seat at quite a young age, and we built the agency together, and I'm still a creative director from afar. And then I moved to the Netherlands, to south. It's a small town called Breda, where I did my master's in graphic design. And then I found myself through a residency in Berlin, fell in love with Berlin like everyone, and then I moved to Berlin. And then lately, so I've been working all that time, and lately I started my PhD at Humboldt University in Berlin in European ethnology. So that's in a nutshell how my career changed from working to studying, to working in research, and then opening to another academic field, basically. So I'm in between all the time.
What residency have you been in Berlin?
It was called the De Rive residency, and it was a partnership between the school, AKW St. Joost, and a Stiftung in Berlin called the Belius Stiftung. And it was basically about exploring the urban space through serendipity. And I came here I was chosen through a proposal that deals with reclaiming stories of migration. And I worked in Berlin for 2 months on a project. And then I went back to Holland to continue my master's. And then, I don't know, things kept happening in Berlin, and Berlin kept calling me for events and a lot of different things. And I found myself back here.
Yeah, that's the thing about Berlin, that it's always calling you with events.
Yeah.
that's a trap. You have to be really careful with that.
And totally.
And how about the HU and your PhD? What is the topic that you were dealing there?
In my master's and throughout my career, I always did political work in general in design. And in my master's, I tackled topics of identity representation, especially with design coming from the Arab world. And then when I moved to Berlin, I actually live in a Stadtteil in Berlin. It's called Neukölln, and it has a predominantly migrant community that is Arab or Turkish, but I live in close to the Arab street called Sonnenallee, and my PhD is about exploring different elements of that identity, this time not through design, but through field research. So I'm working on memory, on identifications, on identity as a whole, and on negotiating all those aspects. Well, but not only visually this time. So it's a different field, but I'm still within the same topic.
So this is not a design PhD then. So it's like a social studies PhD.
Yes, it belongs in the in anthropology. So European ethnology is a part of anthropology, and I've always believed that as a designer working within like the social or political realm, one has to do field work. There is no way out of it, and there is no other way, especially when you're working with actual communities, not living in a design bubble. And basically, ethnology is field work. So I actually found the natural organic evolution of what I like to do as a designer. So I will always stay a designer, but the PhD is not in design.
I don't know how you perceive yourself right now, but I see you becoming really important or like well recognized in the graphic design world. How do you deal with that, and can you explain why is that?
So what happened is that I was always within the circles of criticality. So and then when you're within those circles of design research and criticality, because we are not many, we actually find each other's and create networks. And that's what happened, whether through events like Huarahua or the Digital Bauhaus or any other event I participated in. I actually managed to find like-minded people, and together we created those unofficial networks, basically. And we met and developed things, and we support each other a lot. So I think this is why the name is becoming a bit relevant at the moment. And there's another reason, and that is because I'm leaving design. Like, I'm not leaving design, but because I'm someone who is, let's call it, first generation designer accepted within academia. In that sense, I think I'm opening doors, and I'm glad, but it's a huge challenge for me. And to be very honest, design is going through the same change. And I feel like the more I critique design, the more design wants to hear. And that's a great thing, but that's also can be a lot of responsibility, and I'm aware of that.
When you talk about criticality, what points are it that you criticize in the moment, or where is the pain point where you put the finger in?
I mean, we have to talk about different contexts. If we're talking about the European context of design education, I'm a huge advocate for design leaving the art school. I think by design being within the arts, it's kind of diluting its impact. It's also diluting its responsibility. So if designers will always practice within an art academy, you won't actually know that there are real repercussions for their work. They can actually harm as much as they can help. And they're really not working in an interdisciplinary way. I think design is an independent field that should be out of the academy, and to me, it is closer to human sciences or social sciences or communication disciplines. And the fact that in the European tradition, design is based within the art academy is a dated concept, in my opinion. So that's one of the critical aspects. The second is about field work. It's about designers wanting to be political, but actually only scratching the surface. So it's also something shallow in that sense. So I'm very happy that designers want to be critical. They want to work on topics like feminism, social classes, the discrimination, racism, etc. But it's very important that they do it within a responsible methodological way. But I'm also aware that they are not able to because they are never taught research. So we expect designers now to be critical researchers, but we don't teach them research. And I'm talking about scientific research. I'm not talking about artistic research.
That is very interesting because I teach at design at an art university. But I was trained at an applied science university. And my experience was that having this education at the non-art university makes me appreciate the whole art school much more, because when you say it comes from a heritage or legacy of design is centered in the art schools, there is also this kind of, I don't know when it then that started, but let's say 100 years ago, that it is also in the craft schools and that it's also in the technological approaches schools. Like in my university, we've been the most tiniest department, and the most biggest department was machine engineering. And also there wasn't not real or big interdisciplinarity going on, because if there would have been interdisciplinarity, we would have worked with them and reworked the way we do machining. But it was more like a server thing. Ah, there's the designers. Well, look, we need a color. And that is the point where I see in the art schools is a lot much more open-mindedness to go into urban situation, rural situations, dealing more with sustainability and stuff. So I'm not really 100% there with you in that point.
And that's perfectly healthy. I mean, it needs restructuring. I might not have the perfect answers for how, but I also, because I'm now positioned within a university and within like another department, I can see that the grounds are already there. So in anthropology, there is something called visual anthropology since 50 years maybe. And there is talk about decoloniality since 50 years as well. The fact that designers are now doing anthropological projects without knowing, I find that very absurd and I find that very ridiculous. So anthropologists don't know that designers are already doing the work, and designers don't know that there's a legacy and there's a history, and that work exists already somewhere else. So there's like this lack of communication, there's those like Grenzen that like they are not communicating well. And that's a infrastructure issue in academia that students are not responsible of. But there needs to be a restructuring of that field. It's no longer an aesthetic field. Designers are actually causing inequalities as much as they'd like to think that they're solving them. They're causing them. They're problem makers a lot of times, not solvers. They're sending people to jails with their like tech apps sometimes. They're helping governments and regimes monitor people instead of actually helping people have a better life. So I think the field grew a bit larger than it is right now.
I'm following you on that point, but I think maybe also for me, but I blame it to the listeners that do not know. What do you think of when you talk about anthropology? What is that in the core when you should explain it?
In a nutshell, it's the study of societies, basically, of behaviors, of rituals, habits, traditions, of how people interact with different topics. Basically, it's the study of people. And what is design without it being people-centric? So I find a lot of intersections.
Yes, and I think in design education, it is like that within the observing of people's habits and attitudes and the way they live and they work and how they do things and don't do things, it can't be the whole studies. The studies are always related with the point of dealing with that, creating solutions, but or detecting the problems and proposing workarounds, and still it's this old 60s solution-oriented design approach that is going to be taught in all the departments all around. So it's you have to just see the problem and then create a solution.
I am seeing that changing. I mean, if we see amongst each other as design practitioners or design researchers, we all fly from a conference to another and we all participate in similar things. And actually, when we say, yes, I'm a designer, the next question is, what do you really do? You know, so in a way, this field is becoming actually obsolete alone. It needs to be a hybrid. And it is a hybrid right now. So the second answer would be, yes, I'm a graphic designer, but I work in web. Or I'm a graphic designer, but I'm more into theory. I'm a graphic designer that works for journalism. So all those fields that are design plus should become and will become, there is no way out. They will become a field. Graphic design alone is history. It's obsolete. It should morph into something. And it does. Like the curricula that I'm seeing in all universities are very interdisciplinary. They're inviting people. They're exposing their students. Those students are not necessarily liking all the theory, because a design student wants probably, I don't know, they're expecting to draw and express themselves artistically. And then they get irritated when they have to read more than two pages. But it is happening slowly and surely.
But isn't it good to learn to express yourself artistically, to convert world into an aesthetic outcome, and as a base to be strong in an interdisciplinary cooperation? Because if you are not, it's not on eye level.
Sure, and I'm definitely not against it, but I'm with providing an alternative. So whoever wants to do artistic work to express social issues can go into the fine arts. Mm-hmm. Or can create their own field. You know, if you want to be an artist without necessarily measuring the responsibilities and the repercussions of your work, go do fine arts. But mm-hmm. if you want to be a designer in 2020 plus, you have to be accountable for the harms that you're causing and the cultures you are representing and the people you are working with or not working with and the people you're excluding from your work atmospheres and so on and so forth. So I'm definitely not against artistic mm-hmm. expression. I don't want to be misunderstood. But whoever thinks that that's priority should go into the fine arts. And maybe that's too radical, but I do like to cause some controversy.
So. No, that's totally okay. But for me as a teacher in design context, is, let's say, in an art school, but also like having workshops in outside of the school, for me it's totally reasonable and clear that we should be within the world as designers and work with different people and listen and do all that stuff. But sometimes, and there is a thing that I see in our profession as designers, is that though we try to be really, really good in researching and field researching and doing everything right, a lot of times the wish to us from, let's say, partners or people that we contribute work to is, can you please come up with something special, something that twists the whole thing around? Like, and I think this is something that comes within the freedom of being in an art school. So that is something that is not trained in the let's call it Fachhochschule or I don't want to just like bother somebody from the Fachhochschule, but or in not art centered curricula. So then you will become not, or like in another talk I heard that there are two different approaches. There's market following and market leading. And so if you gotta train, just do what is needed. Then you just do that, and then you will not come up with something new. But if you're going to be trained creating ideas and coming up with new stuff, then you can contribute in another way than the others would do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, let's call it a disciplinary turn we're in right now. So we
Yes,
don't
that's
know
what we are.
what's happening, but we definitely are in some sort of a turn. And you can see the confusion in a lot of design programs, how often they change the descriptions and how often they need new courses. You can see that there is a turn, and confusion is not bad. We have to embrace it, and we have to ride the wave, maybe. And then change might come after.
Yeah, you call it confusion, I call it contradiction. What is Widerspruch? Like, this is something that we're like two points opposite to each other. And like, for example, in no, that's not, no, that's not for the record. Anyway, and the other thing is that or like what we see in the work of our students is the wish to become political, and as you say, to be critical and address political issues. And you do that very much in your work, but maybe not through design, but with design, let's say like this. Where do you see the most, no, not the most, but the most common pain points when working political as a designer?
It depends on the design practice. I mean, in my practice, so I do come from graphic design, but I've seen a lot of problematics happening within graphic design, but also with other disciplines like social design, for example. It can be a very problematic discipline, and I will be teaching within a social design program, so I'm hoping that we can make changes from within slowly, but I think the pain points are that students are not equipped. They want to be political, and they have all the right, and they have all the goodwill. And a lot of them know theory more than me and you. And a lot of them come and can recite and name drop a lot of theorists, and they're very politically engaged. And it makes me so happy that this new generation is by choice like that. But we are failing them, and that's a huge pain point. We are failing them by not training them. So if those designers want to do critical work or research and then apply to conferences, they don't even know how to format a research paper or what is methodology. Or, of course, I'm exaggerating right now because they should, I mean, they can research that. It's not that difficult. But they're not trained to actually know what is a conference, how to participate in one, how to get an abstract to get approved, how to write research. Those like techniques of scientific work that can get critical design students into really large platforms are absent. So at the end of the day, you get a student who wants to be political, and a lot of times and a lot of contexts, they end up creating an app or a website or a brand. It's always like a visual outcome. And I'm one of those who actually were forced into creating a visual outcome as part of my master's, because there was no one before me who said, no, I want to create research. My research is my master's project. They were like, yes, we love that. We appreciate that. But you know, for accreditation purposes, you still need a visual project. This is ridiculous. And we should stop that because the new generation is very, very knowledgeable. They're not stupid.
Yeah. Regarding that, I just can just tell a story too. In the industrial design masters at the Burg, there was a student called Konrad Schoch, and he was researching circularity of mobile phone screens. Because mobile phone screens, maybe I'm doing him wrong because I'm citing him, not exactly, but mostly come from two companies that are situated in Korea, South Korea. And they sell or produce all the displays for all the telephones. So, but there is no chance to recycle them. Not recycle them in a way of like dismantling them and so, but there must be some sort of loop getting these things back to the people who produce it, because it's not such a layouted production where is a plant in the US, one is in Russia, and one is in South Africa, but like this. And the result of his work wasn't a new display. It was a norm, like something that he, like a paper that he gave to the German norm department and to say, you should make a norm for cell phones sold in Germany to be fully recyclable with, in, let's say, in the case of screens. And I found that very, very much inspiring, because it wasn't that, like 10, 15 years ago, they were all about patents. Having a patent to gain money out of an idea that I produced. But this was just, as you said, it was just like a sheet of formatted paper. There was not even some sort of design within this paper. Even it would be a mistake, and that leads to the point that now South Korea has this paper on the desk and has to deal with that. And I really, really, really like that idea. Maybe it's the story is a bit like bigger told than it is in reality, but still I like that. And I there see the impact, not only outcome and output, but there see impact. In a way. And is it something that you would underline as, yes, that's what I talk about?
It is. It definitely is, because I'm also seeing it with students and with workshops I'm giving. I also see that students want their contribution to be whatever it is. They want it to be open format. But we have to admit that we are different generations of academics and teachers and, let's say, practitioners. And a lot of us would like kind of force students into different routes. And I'm one of the people who actually believes that any outcome is a design outcome, and that design can be a process, not necessarily an outcome. The thing is that I want to say something and I forgot it, but I think we should be able to have an infrastructure to allow that. So if a designer wants to present a paper as an outcome, they need to be aware of what that is and how is that done, and not only giving that as an option, or not only using that as a way out, because research mm-hmm. is not a way out for a designer. It's actually much, much more work. And actually designing the research, not designing the research, is also a statement. As much as it hurts me to typeset a paper about decoloniality in Times New Roman, I have to do it. Because otherwise, if I set it with I don't know, female design typefaces like I would love to set it, it won't be regarded as serious in academia. So every field has its own problems, basically. And I still think as a designer, but the infrastructure is absent. And this is what I wish, if I can cause any change, I wish I can cause a change at the level of infrastructures.
When I remember myself, when I left the university and get into like practicing design, I started to write papers for conferences and all that stuff, more on a technological interface design area. And this whole scene was in a way that much the style of the papers framed the way they look into the world, and having these papers all in the same way made all the projects somehow the same, and they lack the sort of design impact that is needed to made it to bring it out of this demo state, out of this weird, there's a table with stuff on it, or there's a wall with a poster, but it didn't really match the needs that we had, like going out and making a derive in the streets. No, there's a Times New Roman poster with abstract about going on the streets, and I really didn't really saw that. And then I left that field because I was so disappointed and bored, basically. And yeah, just adding this. But your personal political thing, and there where you basically come on my screen every time, is about that what you call self-orientalism. And I don't really get it, to be honest. And can you explain it a bit more?
Yes, I can explain it through examples, but I'm just giving a quick definition of it. Orientalism is a way, the critical studies of that started in literature studies, so in different academic fields, and it started by a pioneer in that who's called Edouard Said, who actually is like the canon in that field. So Orientalism is a way of how Europe and the US views a whole area that they call the Orient. However, that area does not exist. So they actually made a fictional construct that says that whoever comes from Southeast Asia all the way to the middle, what is called Middle mm-hmm. East, makes one zone, and they're all together, and they're all forming the other, and that whole area is called the Orient. And they started reproducing things about us. So I come from Lebanon, and I make part of that consciousness or that construct as well. And they started producing things. A very easy concept to understand is Aladdin. Aladdin, mm-hmm. for example, the movie that we all know, is set in a fictional place called Agrabah, and you can never tell if that's in India or in Saudi Arabia or in Syria, or so it's a place that combines all those dark people together and is actually full of exotic stuff. Like, so there are flying carpets and camels and magic and people who steal and people who shoot things. And there's all this like mystified appeal to that place. And that was made in all disciplines. So not only Aladdin and film or gaming or animation, that was made in all disciplines, in literature, and how travelers used to go from Europe to that region and then come back and tell all those stories about the harem and the sex and the dirtiness and the backwardness and the camels. So all those like negative attributes that are totally contrasting with like the rationality of Europe and the greatness of Europe and the modernity, all that created this image. And through coloniality, through colonialism, basically, that area was colonized for long. That created an understanding of someone coming from that area to believe that, yes, I'm part of that Orient and this is what I am. And then if you are trained for like years and years and years through colonialism, that you are backwards, that you are all those negative connotations, you will start believing them and reproducing them. So till now we are studying in a French system in Lebanon, so on and so forth, and we believe those connotations. If our education is still colonial, we believe those concepts and we start reproducing them in design. That's why in a lot of Arab quote-unquote design, you see a lot of stereotypes. You see deserts and camels and Arabesque and Islamic calligraphy. While the Arab world is 22 different countries that don't actually look alike in any shape or form. For example, in Lebanon, we don't have deserts, we don't have camels, so on and so forth. So this whole discipline is Orientalism, and self-Orientalism in my thesis was how designers adopted that concept and started reproducing things for it, because it sells. It sells Europeans, it sells in Dubai, which is like the international appeal and the biggest economic giant in the region, etc. So I don't know if that clarifies.
It clarifies very much. But can you make an example where designers do that?
Yeah, for example, in graphic design in the Arab world at a certain moment in time. So when the region was going through a change and through the power of the capital in Dubai, for example, and all the money that was put to make Dubai the number one in a lot of things, there was a big focus on that image, on how to build the image of the Arab world, on how to build this imagination. So there was a lot of design products that are in product design, in furniture, in fashion, a lot of abayas and a lot of clothing that is like golden and has those Arabic patterns. And it can be very political. And there's one example that you might recognize, or the students might recognize, is the Palestinian keffiyeh, and that's the scarf, the black and white scarf that is very famous. And it's actually a symbol for resistance. It's actually fighters wear that scarf. But through design and through the commodification of that, so they made it a market product. So now you can buy swimwears with that print, you can buy dresses, you can find it in H&M, etc., etc. And this is how you remove a design ornament, in this case, a pattern. That's how you empty it from its political connotation. It becomes just a pattern. And that's what where design did wrong. It becomes just a pattern. Meanwhile, it should have commemorated the Palestinian struggle and the Palestinian resistance against colonialism, against settler colonialism that is Israel. It has more connotations than it actually is reflected through design.
Should it be holy then, in a way, like unadoptable, like not measurable, and how you would, I don't want to say something wrong. That's why I'm quiet.
I get what you want to say. Nothing is holy and nothing is untouchable. Itself, the pattern does not come from Palestine. The pattern comes from Iraq, and it was a fisherman's pattern. It was inspired by the nets that the fishermen used to get fish. So, however, you cannot take an object without its connotations. You have to acknowledge the connotations as a designer, and not strip that object or that symbol from its meaning, basically. So I cannot now take a Nazi symbol and tell you, no, it's just a visual, right? I take it, but I take its history with it, and I put it within a context that can be critical, or can be supportive of a certain cause, or can be paying tribute to a certain culture. And this is what appropriation is, when you take it without its meaning and reformulate it and produce it to a different audience. So you cannot take an object without its meaning as a designer. Of course you can. And it's your right to take things and develop them and produce new things with them. But there's nothing existing in void, in vacuum, nothing.
Yeah, I'm very much with you, but I have to admit that I learned it just recently because I saw it as some sort of freedom to, well, there is an interesting pattern. Why not taking it and making a flyer out of it? And it started it or it, let's say it's a constant flow of gaining consciousness about it. Like, for example, making a flyer with a woman on it. Why is the woman on the flyer? You know it from the Berlin thing, when there is the soul explosion parties where they have all the stickers on the traffic light posts, and it's always a black lady on it with an afro, and then there are some like vinyl record things on it, and I'm always thinking, why? What is that related to that? And I think it's the same thing with that. And my colleague in university recommended me a book that I didn't read, but the title of the book is something that is in my mind since she told me about it, and it's called Everything But the Burden. And this is something that, like, just that sentence gives me a lot of explanation on what appropriation is. Like, it's not that we Can you tell me what is the scarf cloth from Arafat called that you've been talking about?
Kafir.
Kafir, yeah. So I just can't take that and wear it and become something like a political understanding person, because I still do not take the whole struggle with me. And that is something that, it's just that sentence, everything but the burden, that gave me, ah, shit. I can't wear like a nice pink hair klammer and pretend that I'm soft and female understanding, but don't take the whole mental load that a woman is gonna take in a in home situation stuff. So this is something that we, like my generation, and didn't learn in arts in university, that we haven't been sensitified for that, or what do you call it? I don't know the English word. Yeah,
and this is why we need to teach designers to research.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are books about it. I mean, there is one book that it's called Unfashion, and there's another book called Chairman. I forgot the author, Tilbor. Oh shit, we will write it under the podcast. And I had this book laying at home, and my wife was coming just like, hey, what is that? And because it's just showing people wearing, how people wear clothes. And it was called Unfashion. And she was like, what is that? This is so racist, so disrespectful, putting these people into the shop window and exoticize them. And that is... I don't have a solution. I'm just feeling ashamed that it happens to me that I bought.
No, I mean, having a conversation about all that and teaching next generations to do differently is, I mean, there are references. It comes to my mind, a book by Ruben Pater. It's called The Politics of Design. And it has a lot of examples. I mean, it's not as easily recognizable. There are things that are very subtle, like the fluster that you buy for like your wounds. Mm-hmm. It is designed for white people, for example.
It has skin color.
Yeah, exactly. And what we call nude as a color is only nude for white people. So all those design decisions, I mean, it's not easy. And a lot of our, there's something in Holland called Delft blues, and there's ceramics and this like blue pattern that is known to be Dutch. It's not Dutch, it's from like their colonies, basically. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's the same pattern. You find it in Ming porcelain in China, in what's called the Far East. Also, the map of the world is not real. Europe is much smaller than this, and so on and so forth. I mean, those are all decisions that are more or less design decisions.
Yes, and the question
more or less.
I'm following you totally. But where I want to go to is the question, do we address these Missstände, this like irritations by design, or shall we address it within design education, or can we address it through design? Because will people see it if we do not do it? The bad things, as said, you know.
There are different. I don't necessarily separate. I think we should address them whatever we do. And we can address them in different ways. So I'm definitely against making everything a design problem, because designers should learn that not everything rotates around them or their profession.
yeah, we should put that on the headline.
Yes, but they can in different ways contribute to making better decisions. They can be very aware of the, if a graphic designer is super excited to be a graphic designer, still within doing graphic design traditionally, they can take better decisions. They can buy typefaces designed by females, by people of color. They can choose some pro bono causes and work for. They can make a lot of different decisions, a lot of decisions that are ingrained in our choices. They can pay interns, and I know this sounds ridiculous, but a lot of interns are not paid. They can pay speakers fairly in conferences. Mm-hmm. They can actually make sure their conferences are not only gender balanced, but also culturally balanced, because things exist in a sort of intersectional way. So it's not only, making sure we have more than 50% females, But what if you have 90 females, but they're all white, you know? So things happen intersectionally. Designers need to take all those decisions in mind. I'm not telling every designer to go do like a lifetime of research and paper writing. They can make small changes.
That is talking about responsibility and also that how to do that methodologically. You've been talking about the social design and that you were going to teach within a social design, that's, I don't know, department or something. And you've been, as you said, a bit critical about it. Can you tell a bit more about it?
Sure. What I will teach in social design is theory. So it's a lot of theoretical frameworks that are basically decoloniality, a lot of different concepts about racism, about field work specifically. I will invite female design theorists to talk about feminism, and I will make space for other people. And that's also a part of changes that we need in the field. What, if we're going to talk briefly about social design, design is not necessarily an old discipline, but in its first days, let's say in the last decades, 2 decades maximum, it started within a concept that we call parachuting. And it's usually a very stereotypical image that is a bit exaggerated. A group of students from Europe take a plane, go to Africa, spend a week there and create a product or a project. And they call it, we found a problem, we solved it, and that's what social design is. This idea was also encouraged by corporations like IDEO, who actually work within that field and more promoted by something called design thinking, which is one of like the most problematic concepts in design that actually harmed more than it helped. So social design comes from that very colonial process of wanting to save underprivileged contexts. And a lot of times there are many examples of where social designs caused a problem instead of saved a community. There is no way you can actually get to know a problem in 1 week. There is no way that a design solution can solve a problem, especially if it's caused by a structure, by a system. And there must be a way for social design students to look in their own backyard. So problems don't only exist in another continent. Problems are very present and thriving and very happily multiplying in Europe itself. So there needs to be a restructuring of social design. It cannot exist without proper field research. It cannot exist without realizing and admitting to different structural inequalities. And it cannot be apolitical.
And that is the point where I just like go in, because when you, or like, maybe I just give a bit of an example. Beside my work as a professor at the university, I run a design studio, and within the design studio, we have like a non-profit organization, which is basically a gemeinnütziger Verein, as we say in Germany. And within this constellation, we apply for public money to run, how do I explain it, to run a driving digital fab lab that goes into the rural areas in East Germany to bring creative technologies to people who do not have access to that, because like the next fab lab is 200 kilometers away. And we started a bit from that point. Like I think we did a lot of things wrong, as you said. Like, we're going there and has this like, well, we are the guys and we know it, and we now bring you technology and so you can thrive for a better living. That but still, we knew before that this was not gonna work, so that's why we did field research before and did asked a lot of people, and according to the funding institutions, we managed to get a good plan together. And then we've been running this this FabMobile, this driving workshop, to have it now in the third year. But we can't go on like this anymore because we have to be much more political, because we will not get it over this kind of project state. You know, we have to get it more into, like, integrated in the whole financial system of the region. It can't be a thing that we bring the money, we bring the infrastructure, we bring the people, but it should come from them. And that is only working when we go into the politics. That is not, like, designers, like, when you say political, yeah, we can be activists and we can do this and that and you know, like, print flyers and in a silk screen workshop for Antifa demos, but going into the hard discussions in annoying and boring plena for in real democratic decision making processes, that is something that we should learn in university also.
Or learn to work with those people. So this is again another, I will keep taking you to the same argument. This is why we need to take design out of the art school, because designers need to learn how to work with other people. So you don't have to go and negotiate yourself, but you have to learn how to work with maybe like a political studies person, and you have to learn how to work with like a lawyer, a journalist, etc. But also what in that example, what is going well and what in social design sometimes goes wrong is that designers usually work at, so they actually produce something for someone. Mm-hmm. And the actual process that needs to happen here in a nutshell is working with, even if the outcome does not appeal to the designer. Yeah. And this, if you remove solutionism from design, you can make wonders if you actually work with communities. But that needs time. Of course, it needs money, and it doesn't give a lot of validation. It doesn't build a sexy design practice, to be honest.
It was so frustrating in the beginning when we've been when we went with this bus through the rural countryside and we let the kids do their thing. I was super disappointed. Hey, what is that? Where is that happening? And it took me really a long time to accept that they will not be me.
Yeah. So, exactly. And this is a mantra I give to a lot of design students. I'm like, you have to repeat, I am not my work. Mm-hmm. I am not my work. And this is a big mistake that we all designers are trained in a way that, like, design is a lifestyle, or mm-hmm. like art is a life, like I'm an artist, you know, it's who I am. No, it's a job. And the moment we start thinking of it as a job, that's the moment we start billing people well, being mm-hmm. responsible, earning well, supporting other, making structures and systems. I'm not saying totally rationalizing, and also rationalizing is a very male colonial concept, but we need infrastructures for that building to survive.
Yeah, and also you can criticize the work much more better because you do not criticize the person through it. Like that is something that finding objective arguments for the work is something really, really important. And not like if I could just like that's not what I do, but if I would do crush an idea of a student, like this is on this, these points does not, let's say, just make it short, it's wrong, it's not good, it's bad. Then usually I do not criticize the person who does it, but through this kind of mindset that you just like work from your inner self. This like that you just that you're like a querel, is it querel Steinbruch, where you just like take the stuff out from you and you are the resource, that makes it totally complicated to work with. I could not imagine to work with art students because it's I used to do it in the University of the Arts in Berlin. You can't talk to them in the end because all their argument is, no, I like it like that. And that's
exactly, but this is also a lack of criticism. Who teaches mm-hmm. designers how to critique or to receive criticism? Mm-hmm. There is no design criticism. There are few big names that call themselves critics, but there is no discipline.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's another story maybe, but this is very important in design education, critique.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I came up with the idea of, I call it ideadvocacy. Like, there is this idea that you have, and you're some sort of advocate for that idea. It's not you. It's like if you're being in a courtyard, and the idea is here, and you're just... that's why I'm a bit bad to understand, because I step next to the microphone, and I'm right next to it, and I defend it. But it's not me. If it fails, it's not my personal thing, because it's, I couldn't find much more arguments to hold.
Sure. And the idea should live alone. If the idea cannot live alone, it's bad design. But I think that's a big topic as well, but it's equally important.
I'm just because we are already near an hour talking. You do the after show specials, and can you tell me, there was this it will still happen, the thing in Berlin. Can you tell a bit more about Orientalism and Identity and the event that's going to happen?
Yes, it's so I don't know if when this podcast will be out, it will probably have happened. So it's in June 25, and it's a lecture or a presentation that is not academic. So it's targeting practitioners, basically. So it's a lot of visual examples on what Orientalism is, on how can we designers be aware of those examples and make better decisions. It's a lot about like how we talked in this conversation, but a bit more interactive and visual. This term, and I use it because I'm becoming known for it for a reason I don't know, but what I want to highlight through that presentation is design that represents, reclaims, and represses. So it's really important to know the role of design as a representational tool. Mm-hmm. So it's a communication discipline, so we represent people and cultures. And we can, with design, repress and create a lot of horrible things, a lot of problematics. And we've seen, even in branding, the strongest brands in the world, I don't know, the Nazi brand is one of the strongest brands in the world. Make America Great Again is one of the strongest brands in the world. Those were designed. There is a guideline for mm-hmm. those brands. And the third thing is to reclaim, because through design and through creating counter design projects, and mapping is called counter mapping, mm-hmm. and it's a field that exists since a very long time, and I also talk about it. We can do counter design, we can design back, so or design up as well. Those are concepts coming from the humanities and the social sciences as well, writing up. So it's counter European or Eurocentric knowledge. We can produce design outcomes that are counter that, in order to provide alternatives, in order to counter a long system that is based in colonial education. As an example, in Lebanon, we learn Swiss design. Mm-hmm. We are trained in Latin typography. We are very rarely using Arabic. And if we are, we use Arabic without questioning, mm-hmm. Without being critical about it or with it. So all those examples will be in the next lecture. Yes, and I think I'm more and more like 1 foot in anthropology and research, and 1 foot in design, and giving different presentations on topics like Orientalism, self-representation, counter-mapping, and things like that.
Sounds great. And there's also, it will be available as a podcast too.
Yes, so it will be a very small event, depending on the restrictions by then in Berlin. And it will be on Instagram Live, and it will be available as a podcast, I think. Yes.
Do you often these Instagram Live things? I see it quite often, and but I just like pop into these events, and I think, I can't do it. I'll just leave again.
Yeah, no, I don't actually. This was arranged by the agency that invited me to speak. Mm-hmm. So I'm not necessarily a person that creates events for themselves. So I get invitations like today and participate when it's feasible. And yeah, I mean, I try as much as possible to actually address those same issues that we go in circles and address. And yeah, I'm happy there are more open ears and willingness to listen.
Imad, thank you very much for that great talk. Yeah, it was a big pleasure, and we will try to put all the links to everything we talked about under the podcast, so everybody can dive into the topics of Orientalism and bilingual visual communication and all the stuff we talked about later on. Okay, cool. Thank
Perfect.
you.
Yes, thank you, Christian, for the invite again. I just want to tell the students that they've done a great job with the first edition of the festival, and I really hope to see it happening again. It was super fun. It was critical in its own ways, and it was fresh breeze that we need in design. We need more student organized things. That are quite politically aware in their own way, and I'm looking forward to the next editions.
Cool. Thank you. Der Design Podcast der Burg.